Rider Than You on the Infinity Sports Network on a Thursday morning, still without our fearless leader. Bill remains off all week. Andrew Bogish in for him for the second straight day. Thanks, as always, for hanging with us over these next 2 hours on all our great Infinity Sports Network / Odyssey affiliates, the Odyssey app, SiriusXM channel 375. However you are listening, we appreciate it. As always, phone lines open for you at 888-710-4ISM. That's 888-710-4476. You can get us on Twitter at Andrew Bogish, at Ryan underscore Hickey 3. Evan Washburn ups the ante. Great hair, handsome guy, much more talented broadcaster. He's on the show in hour number 2. We'll play Would You Rather because it's Thursday. We'll play Buy or Sell because it's a day. We've got some updates from things we talked about yesterday that we'll get to this morning as well. But let's begin with my official opening to a new NFL season. It's not training camp's opening. It is not the Hall of Fame game in Canton, with all due respect to the Hall of Fame and that great weekend and the players that go into Canton. I don't need the game in addition to all those other great events. When I know the season is almost here, when I know it's time to go to the next level of preparation and be hook, line, and sinker into a brand new NFL season, when I know it's that time, it's when Hard Knocks debuts. And this year, Hard Knocks, the HBO legacy show, is following the Buffalo Bills. And the premiere episode was on Tuesday night. I have had a chance now to finish watching the first installment of Bills Hard Knocks, and it is, as usual, an infomercial, and I fully expect 3 weeks from now to believe that the Buffalo Bills are going to go 17-0 and win everything, and they have the best this guy and the best that guy. We already know they have one of the best quarterbacks on the planet in Josh Allen. And episode one in particular is a Josh Allen infomercial as much as it is about the Buffalo Bills. There's a lot of Josh Allen. There's wedding talk. There's a tour of the new stadium. I forgot that this was the last year in old Ralph Wilson. I knew the new building was coming, and every time you see a picture of it, it is exponentially more progressed. I didn't realize that this was the transition year. So that's another theme in Hard Knocks, and Josh Allen is walking around finding where the sauna is going to be and the cold tub's going to be and where he takes the field at halftime. So there's a lot of fluff about Josh Allen. He's signing autographs. Kids are loving him. There's a bazillion shots of fans in Allen jerseys and T-shirts at training camp, getting autographs, begging for his attention. But there's also a couple of significant looks into Josh Allen's demeanor, his mindset, his goals moving forward in his Hall of Fame caliber career. And here's a clip of Allen talking about what he needs to do for him, for his career, and for the greater Buffalo area.
Being mentioned for MVP means your team is doing really well, probably in the hunt for the playoffs, and you're doing your job. It doesn't change my life to have that accolade or to have more of those accolades. The only thing that I'm worried about is doing everything I can to bring a Lombardi trophy here.
Now, it's what he's got to say. It's what every franchise quarterback has to say. It's what every elite quarterback has to say. It's what every quarterback who quarterbacks a team that's in the Super Bowl conversation has to say, that MVPs, individual honors, they're great, but they really don't matter. I need to win the whole damn thing. So, of course, on one hand, Josh Allen is saying that. But on the flip side is, you believe it from him maybe a little more than other guys, because we all like to be patted on the back. We all like the recognition that we're doing a good job, no matter what our job is. We want people to notice, and we want to be celebrated. And if there's an Employee of the Month award, or around here, you can get free Odyssey coins to get some Odyssey-branded gear. Like, if someone's going to give me 10 Odyssey coins, thanks a lot. That's going to change my day. We don't have a Super Bowl of radio to try and win around here, so there's no, like, it ends our goals with Odyssey coins. But Josh Allen has more things to go after. And as he says that, he means it, but it led me to think, like, and don't forget, he's the reigning MVP, and he's also 3 top fives. He has been in the AP top 5 in voting more than he has. I think it's 4 years, 3 top fives and a win, and then one season where he didn't make top 5. So, like, this is how good and how dominant Josh Allen has been. But he lives in a world, at least from my vantage point, where he's not necessarily immune from criticism, but we're not, unless I'm missing it, like, we're not banging down the door of Josh Allen go win this. Now, the Bills have the pressure. They are the lovable losers. I was just talking the other day, too. Marv Levy turned 100 years old. Was it over the weekend? Was it Monday? Within the last week. And it got me into a conversation, and I ended up doing a sports minute about it as well. If you put the four straight Super Bowl appearances in a vacuum and you take away the heartbreak of the loss and the fact that they didn't win one before that run, they haven't won one since, there is, and I can make this argument as an outsider, getting to four straight Super Bowls is as impressive as winning one in my mind. Like, you want to win one, you trade four for one, I get all of that. But knowing how hard it is and how many things are thrown at you, whether it's injuries, less back then in terms of like contract issues and whatnot, but there's a lot of ways that the universe can prevent you. It's why what the Chiefs are doing now is so damn impressive, because there's nothing easy about making one, let alone making two. And then three and four, it's almost preposterous. And all of them that were there for the bulk of that run, starting with Marv Levy, rightfully so, live in a very high regard in NFL history. But that is the Bills' history. And the pressure is significant on Josh Allen, whether he's an all-time QB or just a very good one for right now, is to lead them back to that Super Bowl. And he's gotten the championship game twice, but not won that. The Chiefs got him both those times, as we all know. He needs to get there. So there is inherent pressure as the Bills' quarterback to get there and to win the Super Bowl. But Josh Allen's not Lamar Jackson. Josh Allen detractors, you could probably count on one hand. It feels like almost everyone's out to get Lamar, and we're constantly demanding Lamar to fix his resume. He can't win another. He's got to win postseason games. He's got to be better in the postseason before we can win another MVP. Like, enough's enough. Like, where am I missing the negative Josh Allen conversation? Josh Allen has pressure on him, but Josh Allen's pretty Teflon. You throw in the fact that he's got, and I'm not saying he shouldn't be like that, but he has the script and the takes on Josh Allen haven't flipped yet. Maybe it's as soon as this year, but the Bills' shortcomings don't get held against him like they get held against other people. And when you ask, like, which quarterback has the most pressure on him going into this season, Josh Allen's not my answer. Because I don't see the group of people who are waiting to pounce on Josh Allen if the Bills don't win the AFC, if they don't win their division easily, if they don't get to the AFC title game, if they don't get to the Super Bowl, if they lose the Super Bowl. I don't know. We're not going to, I can't imagine there's going to be all these exposés and radio and TV takedowns of what Josh Allen is or is not, which people are way too eager to do around Lamar Jackson. Lamar Jackson needs to win a Super Bowl just to get all these people off his back. And maybe so we could finally respect his game and his resume the way it probably deserves to be. Josh Allen is second on that list, because when you really think about it, after that, the unique pressure, the unique situations are the ones that have already been there. You know, Joe Burrow comes to mind too, but much like Josh Allen, we don't blame Joe Burrow for the things that the Bengals do wrong or the shortcomings. I mean, last year, Joe Burrow had an historically good offensive season. And they were historically good, especially in the back half of the year, where they had to recover from their front half of the year and almost got themselves into the postseason. You know, that season ends, and it's not, you know, Joe Burrow this, Ja'Marr Chase that. Is make sure that Chase and Higgins are signed for forever to stay with Joe Burrow. They fired their defensive coordinator. They're picking a fight with Trey Hendrickson. They've turned over the roster as much as possible on the defensive side of the ball. There's no heat on Joe Burrow. So he's got just kind of the built-in regular pressure. Jaden Daniels has some pressure in terms of making good on what they did and what he did last year, but he's also a brand new quarterback, so to speak, and on a team that has time here to stub its toe on its move up into the NFC. And you stay in that division, Dak Prescott's always going to have eyes on him because he's the Cowboys QB, and now he makes all of that money. But that's not new, it's not different, it's not heightened, it just, that is the nature of the beast. When it comes to being the Cowboy quarterback, and specifically right now, Dak Prescott. The guy who I would throw into this mix here, and this is where the kind of a personal change for me, is Justin Herbert. Because I stay on the Justin Herbert, the side of the argument that that's a franchise quarterback that almost everybody in the NFL would trade their guy to get Herbert. But there are plenty of people with plenty of backup and support, arguing for a long time, or for a couple of years now, that Justin Herbert is not good as the rest of us think he is. And now you've got Jim Harbaugh, who is the ultimate PR guy as a head coach, telling you every other day how elite and different and great his quarterback is. But just this is a put-up-or-shut-up season for Justin Herbert. One way or the other, we're going to land on a conclusion about what he is. So there, to me, there's pressure on Herbert to be elite, to carry the Chargers, to make them better than they're supposed to be over injuries, roster issues, whatever it may be. He needs to overcome those things, which I think is the fairest critique of his career so far. He has been good. At times, he has been great. You can, in every game, see the elite skill set that he has. But he has not been transcendent. He has not done what Joe Burrow did last year, which was almost single-handedly, as a unit, not as a person, win multiple football games to balance out a completely woeful other side of the football. You don't need to be reminded how bad the Bengals were on defense last year, and the way that the Bengals scored points almost made that a moot point. Justin Herbert hasn't done that. I think he can, but maybe he can't. And this is the year we have to get to a point where we kind of put up or shut up, or you know what, or get off the pot with Justin Herbert as the quarterback of the LA Chargers. And then there's another tier of pressure where a guy like J.J. McCarthy lives, because J.J. McCarthy is about to be the quarterback of a team that, if he's passable at his position, is a Super Bowl possibility. If he's not, then he ruins that, air quotes. But also, he's a rookie quarterback. Not technically, but he is. And he's coming off a fairly significant knee issue that lingered and required a second surgery. So it's not about necessarily a career-defining season for J.J. McCarthy, but he steps into this situation where he's maybe the deciding factor on whether or not his team is a Super Bowl contender, which swings us all the way back to Josh Allen, and his Bills are certainly Super Bowl contenders. And it's hard to imagine, and I think, again, this is where the pressure on him is there, but not as high as on Lamar Jackson, is we assume Josh Allen will do everything he can for the Bills. And if they don't get to the AFC title game, if they don't win a Super Bowl, if they don't get there, that it's not going to be his fault. And that's a nice place to be in. It's a nice place to sit there and go, everyone's going to celebrate me. Everyone's going to love me. I'm going to make all these great plays. I'm going to run over guys. I'm going to make beautiful touch throws. I'm going to throw fastballs. We're going to play in one of the best visuals when it gets to wintertime in Buffalo that the league has to offer. They're bringing back the red helmets this year too at times. They're going to have that in their favor. They're in a division that is very winnable at the moment with the Jets and the Patriots and the Dolphins and, you know, relative struggles depending on which situation we're talking about. And we just assume that Josh Allen is going to have an MVP-type season. And it's going to be, you know, a lack of skill position players, maybe a defensive issue, maybe his head coach. I mean, I think there's an argument that Sean McDermott has more pressure on him to be good this year than Josh Allen because of mistakes that he has made in clock management and timeout usage and other things like that. Like, even before we get to Lamar Jackson, the person in Buffalo who has the most pressure on him might be the head coach and then maybe the GM. And then maybe it's Josh Allen. But either way, it's time for all of us to be Bills fans. I don't know how you watch Hard Knocks. This is a yearly tradition for all of us where you watch it and you go, that guy's cool. That guy's funny. You might have seen Deion Dawkins have his kid in a drifting car in a helmet that didn't fit. That's a whole other debate. I don't know how that fits into all of this, but Trey White is running up hills and buying ice cream for people in upstate New York. What's not to like about the Bills? But for the most part, they deserve it, and their quarterback deserves it because he's an absolute stud, and he's got his sight sets on the right things at the moment. And the best news is we're about to find out if they actually can get to where he wants to go, because we have real-ish football games. Our first full weekend of preseason action, it begins tonight, which means we are that much closer to week one when it all matters. Evan Washburn, who is the sideline reporter for Ian Eagle and J.J. Watt. Now, that is the change at CBS's NFL lineup this year. He's been on a little training camp tour, getting getting set for his games, the teams he's going to see during the season. He's going to join us to kick off hour number two this morning. When we come back, we're going to go back to yesterday's show, revisit in case you missed it, what Steve Phillips said when I asked him about Shohei Ohtani pitching and hitting. And then after Steve said what he said, Ohtani went out and pitched and hit and explained exactly why he should keep doing what he is doing. Plus, I found myself in a very difficult sports fan predicament yesterday, and I need your help working through that. So all of that in just a second. It's Writer Than You on a Thursday on the Infinity Sports Network.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast. Welcome back to Writer Than You.
One of the happiest moments of my life, like outside the birth of my kids and Mary and Lori, one of my happiest moments of my entire existence was the first time that I saw, I don't know if it was a video or live, Robin Ventura charge a 40-year-old pitcher and then have Nolan Ryan put him in a headlock and beat him senseless like he was a steer. I don't know what that says about me other than I like baseball.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
Might not just be a baseball take there from Bill. I think, by the way, is this why you play that, Hickey? I think we are near the anniversary of that, of the Ventura-Nolan Ryan fight.
I don't know the date, so this is just a coincidence.
Yeah, I could have sworn that in the last week I saw a tweet like this date in baseball history, and it was, I mean, I assume everyone by now has seen this, but Nolan Ryan's in his mid-40s, and Robin Ventura is a young player on the White Sox and makes a terrible decision to charge the mound, and Nolan Ryan catches him in a headlock and basically gives him noogies in one of the most embarrassing fights in baseball history for Ventura.
August 4th, 1993.
So there we go. So we're, what, three days removed from that? 93, 32 years. Oh, man, I'm cooked. But speaking of baseball and unique pitchers, it's the question. It's always going to be the question, I guess, until we get a definitive decision the decision is made for him and us. It's whether or not Shohei Ohtani should continue pitching and hitting because he's had multiple elbow issues. He has missed time then on the field hitting because of that. He no longer plays the field because of all of this. Last time we saw him on the mound last week, he had to leave the pitching part of his night because he was having cramping in his hip. And as I mentioned yesterday in our very good long-ranging conversation with Steve Phillips, the numbers are the numbers, and those numbers say that Ohtani's offensive stats dip when he's pitching. That pitching and the recovery takes its toll on Ohtani hitting, and it doesn't just affect the day he pitches. It affects him across the board. For whatever reason, he is less dangerous as an offensive player when he's also pitching. But he keeps pitching. And yesterday he pitched for the first time since the cramping, and he pitched pretty well. We'll give you those details after you hear what Steve Phillips said yesterday, the former Mets GM, MLB Network analyst now, and I asked him if he was in the Dodgers front office, what he or how he would want to handle Ohtani.
His body was giving out on him, I think, making a statement that it was rejecting being a two-way player. He started getting cramps in his hands, in his side, in his hamstring. And then the next thing you know, he breaks down, needs Tommy John surgery. So he's worked his way back, and he really wants to pitch. But his last time out, he's got cramping in his hip. I just don't think his body at this stage is going to accept being a two-way player. I think it's too much wear and tear and, you know, too much on his bottom half, and then, you know, which leads to him mechanically getting out of sync and then blowing out his elbow.
I reluctantly say that I think Steve is right. I think at some point in the nearish future, Ohtani will back off of his demand to keep pitching and hitting, and he will just hit, and he will be a legendary hitter and win more MVPs and hit hundreds of home runs. But I don't want to get to that date. I remain fascinated and flabbergasted and overwhelmed by what this guy can do, because it is everything that we have been told that's not possible. I've played baseball for as long as I can remember. I love the sport unlike anything else. It is easily my favorite. In the winter, once in a while, I'll say, oh, hockey, but I love baseball. I love baseball. I can watch any kind of baseball game. The fact that my son loves it now is one of the great gifts I've ever been given by anybody. I love watching him play. I love watching Little League games, period. I even love coaching Little League as with all the nonsense that goes into all that. I love the game. And forever, it's like, okay, sure, you hit and pitch in Little League, you hit and pitch in high school, some guys hit and pitch in college. At some point, pick one, let's go. You can't do both. And Babe Ruth is the obvious one, and the reference point, as usual, we forget a huge chunk of baseball history and the population, and there were multiple people who were very good pitchers and hitters throughout the history of the Negro Leagues. There are names in there that did things that Babe Ruth didn't do, but Babe Ruth is the comparison point for Shohei Ohtani, and I'll remind you that we're basically 100 years removed from Babe Ruth playing baseball. Like, that is how unicornish Ohtani is. And again, yesterday, he goes out there, and in the middle of the day, so he's got the sun beating down on him, he throws 4 innings, he strikes out 8, so he got 12 outs, 8 of them by strikeout, and he had a 2-run home run. That was just yesterday. And this is from Sarah Langs, who's a must-follow on social media, Slangs on Sports. The most home runs in a season while making multiple pitching starts in NBA history, Ohtani now owns the top 4 of them. 21, 22, 23, and this year 25. It's not supposed to be like this. It's just not supposed to be like this, and I don't want it to end. But I think it's going to have to end because I think Steve is right. And there were a couple months ago, Tom House, who is a pitching guru, he has worked for teams, he has worked outside the actual MLB. He has a football pedigree, he's got a baseball pedigree, and he was on Pablo Torre's podcast. And his argument against Ohtani pitching and hitting, he just simply said that he's too big to pitch. Almost, you take the hitting out, he's so big and so muscular that he's putting too much force and too much whatever on his body parts. That if he was just a pitcher, he would struggle to stay healthy. And now you throw in the fact that he's trying to be this elite hitter as well, and it just doesn't make sense. And you're not going, because his body is built to be the hitter. His body is not built to pitch and then he hits. His body is built hitting first and then pitcher. And that is leading to some of the health issues that we have seen and then probably we'll see in the future if he keeps doing it. So we're going to get to that point where they're going to have to pick just the hitting, but I hope it's years away. And I hope he stays healthy. I hope we can find, the Dodgers can find a good sweet spot. They can get some luck and he can just keep doing this because it's never not fascinating. It's never not fascinating. And it was again yesterday. 4 innings, 8 Ks, and a 2-run homer. It's not supposed to be like that, and I love every second of it. Now, what I didn't love yesterday, speaking of pitching as well, is being at Citi Field. Now, the long story is the Mets are terrible. The last 2-plus months, they get no length from their starting pitching, which taxed their bullpen, so for a while their bullpen couldn't get an out. And all these pitching issues, not even close to being negated by a completely listless offense. Lindor, Alonso, Soto, average down. They don't hit well situationally. All of their young players have not stepped up. They're still an okay team. I still think they make the playoffs, but they're not a good baseball team right now. That's the big picture. Singularly, yesterday is they were getting no hit by Gavin Williams of the Guardians. There's a very trendy term now amongst pitchers. Shove is a new verb for pitching. It's shove day when you pitch, or he shoved. Gavin Williams shoved yesterday, like right in the Mets' face. They didn't do anything. They had one ball that was almost a hit where the right fielder made a diving play, a little flare in the right field off Mark Vientos' bat. The hardest hit ball of the game might have been one in the first inning that came back and knocked Gavin Williams' glove off. His glove helicoptered off his left hand. He ran to pick up the ball and threw out Francisco Lindor first base. It was dominant. And I'm at the game. Now, I was there through here with my press credentials, so I had to be on my best behavior. There was no rooting. I was just watching a baseball game. And I'm sitting in the press box next to Pat McCarthy, who's one of the voices of the Mets. He was doing pre- and post-game yesterday. And then Ray Martell, who is a longtime employee here and right now is the executive producer of Mets Radio. And we're sitting there going, you know, it starts out for seven innings of like Mets perspective. Like, this is, I can't believe this. Fans are antsy, whatever. And then it's all of a sudden like, this dude's got a no hitter. And, you know, the pitch count is doable at the moment. He had 90 something in the seventh inning. So we're doing the math, like how many need to get through here. They're going to leave him in. They're going to leave him in. So then it switches to now you're in no hitter mode. And this to me is again where baseball is different from the other sports, because there is no comparison to anything else. Like there is in basketball and football and hockey, there is no hitter. There is no singular event that you can focus on. It's not a shutout. It's not, was it Jared Goff last year that was 19 for 19? Like that's an anomaly. It's not an accomplishment. We don't know everybody that's ever done it. Like there isn't these landmarks in the other sports. So now you're going, all right, I started off being a little annoyed that the Mets, again, were doing nothing, just dead in the water. But I'm sitting there going, I've never seen a no-hitter before. I'd prefer to watch my team throw one. I've seen them come close a couple of times. But do I want them to get no-hit right now? Do I want to see a no-hitter in person? Because it's also, not only is it good for Gavin Williams, the Guardians righty, but there's all, like, I feel like fans, baseball fans want to check things off. Like, I've seen a no-hitter. Boom. I've seen a grand slam. Boom. So I'm sitting there going, and we're talking amongst the three of us, like, who has seen one before? Have you ever seen one? Have you ever seen one? And I was the only one that hadn't seen one. I'm like, now I really want, I think I want to see one. Now, thankfully, Juan Soto prevented that. So I didn't see it, but I think I was a little annoyed that I didn't see it yesterday. And I don't know if that makes me a bad Mets fan, that I was almost disappointed, Hickey, that they didn't get no hit. And I feel like me enjoying, air quotes, the no-hitter would have been fleeting, because by the second I got out of the stadium on my way home, I would have been stomping my feet that they just got no hit and this two-month swoon continues. But I think in my heart of hearts, I was kind of rooting against them for a little bit in the ninth inning yesterday.
So I was rooting for the no-hitter, but not for history. I just want them to be embarrassed.
You wanted rock bottom.
I wanted rock bottom. Okay. I need a wake-up call. And I'm like, maybe getting no-hit is what you need. And going back to last game, too, I think the last hit was the fourth inning. So it's like no-hit for like 15 innings. I haven't gotten a hit.
Yeah.
They stink.
So they were kind of, in a way, they were no-hit because they went more than almost a game and a half between hits.
Right. It's really bad. So I'm like, you know what? This has to be the wake-up call. If anything's going to change, this is it. So that was, for me, my motivation for history. Otherwise, if they were just, whatever, a fine team or playing well and this just happened to run into a hot pitcher, I could never. I think it's just so embarrassing.
Yeah, the context always matters. Things never happen in a vacuum. But baseball, again, it gives you these things that other sports don't give. And I remember Johan Santana's no-hitter from the Mets perspective happened while I was out at an event from my 10-year college reunion. So, like, I have this weird memory of watching that game in a bar, no sound, with people I hadn't seen in years, and we were supposed to be doing all this other stuff, moving around, changing locations, and people were like, we're not leaving, and we stayed there. So I'm sitting there yesterday going, like, I think I want this to happen, and I went back and forth on whether I was being a terrible fan or not.
Can I ask you this? Now, you said you're in the press box,
yeah.
So obviously no cheering. It's the rule.
Yeah.
A lot of other Met fans, though, when Gavin Williams was removed from the game after the Juan Soto home run, and I think subsequent after that, whatever it was.
He walked the next batter, and they took him out.
Standing ovation.
Yeah.
Do you have a problem with that?
No. Now, I didn't. It caught me off guard how loud it was and how it was almost unanimous. Is that the right word? Like, it wasn't just a smattering of people or it was most of the people that left, because a lot of people, when Soto homered, they were gone. Like, they stayed to see the no-hitter, Soto homered, and they left. So, and it wasn't a full house to begin with on a Wednesday afternoon. There were a lot of campers, and they leave to get back on their bus, to get back to camp, to go home. So the stadium probably had 30,000 people in it, and then some of those left because of the Soto hit. But I would say 80% of the people who were still there got to their feet and gave this guy a standing ovation. So it kind of took me off guard. But I think I would have done the same thing if I was sitting in a seat, because, again, it was so damn impressive. He was so good. He bullied them for 8-plus innings, made them look useless. And again, what's, I think, unique to baseball is he has this moment where the manager goes and gets the ball, and now he's walking off the field. So now he's by himself. Nothing else is happening. So it's, you know, I guess a basketball player can be subbed out of a game for scoring 100 points, and that's like, that's the moment where he walks off. But you're also kind of forced to do something as a fan because he's walking off, and normally you would have applauded your guy for pitching like that. So it felt like good sportsmanship. You can boo him, you can curse him, you could have been doing everything you thought necessary to break up the no-hitter, changing seats, saying the word out loud, but then he doesn't get it. The game is over basically at that point. It did not bother me, people applauding. Not even a little bit. I was surprised, but I was not disappointed or angry, and I probably would have done the same thing. Peter Schwartz is here.
I've been to three no-hitters.
I don't think your mic is on for some reason. You've been to three. I didn't hear you at first.
Yeah.
You've been to three no-hitters.
Yeah.
You were at the David Wells beanie?
Yep.
Okay, that one
so
I remember.
Was at Jim Abbott, David Wells, David Cohn.
Now, Abbott.
And I had tickets for Doc Gooden and didn't go.
How old were you for the Abbott one?
Oh.
How long ago?
I covered that game. That was like 93.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. I was thinking, so for some reason, my mind went to Dave Righetti's no-hitter, and that's why I was asking how old you were.
I listened to that on the radio at the pool with my family that day.
But I heard you this morning on Maggie and Perloff said that you did not like the cheering by Mets fans yesterday.
I would have been fine with it had he pitched the no-hitter, because then you're saluting history and a job well done. If I was a Met fan, I would have been so disgusted by my team's performance that I don't think I would have cheered him for not pitching the no-hitter.
Yeah, I mean,
if
went right.
If it was a no-hitter, yes, I think I would have done it.
They went right back to the booing after the applause. So yeah. There was a momentary lapse.
If it was the Yankees and the guy was pitching a no-hitter, I think I'm with you. I think at that point, it's 4-0. I think, you know what, I'd like to see another no-hitter.
No, don't get greedy. You've already seen three.
Yeah. Well, three from my team, but like, it would be different seeing it against your team. But I couldn't cheer a great performance if he didn't finish it off.
Yeah, it was still a great performance. It wasn't historical. His name's not going to go on that list, but it was still impressive. And I think the assumption also was he was going to get it because they were just doing nothing against him. So, it was something. I was actually the one thing that this is going to sound mean. I was a little disappointed when we were getting deep in the game, and it was a very real reality that it wasn't a pitcher of higher stature. That crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't Max Scherzer, it wasn't Jacob DeGrom, it wasn't, you pick your front line, it wasn't Paul Skeens. Like, it wasn't going to be like, oh man, I saw Sandy Koufax throwing no-hitters. Like, I saw a guy for the Guardians, his name was Gavin Williams throwing no-hitters. Like, it was going to be like that.
You know when David Cohn pitched the perfect game,
mm-hmm.
people forget there was a rain delay in that game, in the middle of the game.
How long?
Half an hour, 40 minutes.
So long enough for today where you probably wouldn't have come back.
Yeah, yeah. And it was Yogi Berra day. That's when Don Larson threw the first pitch to Yogi Berra, and then Cohn goes out and throws a perfect game himself.
So he does that on that day, and then Wells is on Beanie Baby
Beanie
Day.
Baby.
Which
still
becomes,
have the Beanie Baby.
Of course you do. How much is it worth, do you think?
I have no idea. Not interested in getting rid of it.
You've never even checked on the what the cost is?
Years ago, I don't think it was that crazy. And I had an individual credential for that day, so I've got the press pass and the little case with it.
Do you have a scorecard? Do you keep score?
I have the scorecard from the Jim Abbott no-hitter.
Okay.
I don't have it from the other two. So,
all right.
Ticket stubs.
Peter Schwartz always wins. Three no-hitters. Yeah. I can't get one.
Two perfect games.
Whatever.
And I told you I had tickets for Doc Gooden and I didn't go.
Why didn't you go?
Stayed home to watch the Stanley Cup playoffs on TV.
An Islander game?
I don't remember. I think my buddy of mine and I decided we wanted to stay home because we had the tickets.
Right, how did you know?
Freebies from Modell's. We bought something, got freebies. And I'm like, I don't really feel like schlepping to the Bronx tonight. And boy, I was keeping my eye on that. I'm like, I just hope he gives up a hit.
That's my least favorite Yankee one. Gooden doing it as a Yankee. I can't. I just... Whoever did that, I can't forgive them. Whatever universal power was behind that, dead to me. We come back. It's time to play Would You Rather. It's Thursday. We'll do that after your update. Here's Peter.
Infinity Sports Network. Sports Flash.
And I think both Gooden and Strawberry have multiple World Series rings
with the
Yankees. This report is sponsored by Progressive Commercial Insurance, protecting your business vehicles 24/7. See if you can save at progressivecommercial.com. Afternoon baseball coming up 12:05 Eastern, the Athletics at the Nationals. And later this afternoon, 4:10 Eastern for the White Sox at Mariners. And speaking of Paul Skeens, Skeens is on the mound for the Pirates this evening as they host the Reds at 6:40 Eastern time. NFL preseason, Colts visit the Ravens tonight. Colts head coach Shane Steichen has a plan for quarterbacks Anthony Richardson and Daniel Jones for the first 2 weeks of preseason.
Anthony will start on Thursday. The plan is for him to play about a quarter and a half, and then get Daniel about a half a quarter. In a perfect world, that's how I want it to play out. And then the following week against Green Bay, Daniel will start, get about a quarter and a half, and then Anthony will play about a half quarter.
Kickoff tonight, 7 Eastern. Also tonight, the Bengals and Eagles. The Seahawks host the Raiders. I'm Peter Schwartz.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast.
Welcome back to Writer Than You.
I have a theory. You cannot come up with a new professional sports team name without people thinking it's dumb. Because all the names are dumb until you kind of get used to them. Other than the Bears, that's a great one.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
This portion of Writer Than You is brought to you by Wesley Financial. Stuck in a timeshare and want out? Contact Wesley Financial Group now and get a free timeshare exit information kit at wesleyfinancialgroup.com. Welcome back to the show. Closing out hour number one, Andrew Bogish in for Bill Ryder. He is off all this week. He's back on Monday, but then Hickey's not here. So you're still a ways away from the A-team and the actual people on the show being actually on the show. That's just kind of how August works, because tomorrow I've got something else going on. Then next week I'm doing something different as well. We're all moving around. Everybody's taking vacation time because the days are running out for us to not be here, because football is almost here. Evan Washburn, NFL on CBS. He will join us in hour number two. But right now, it's Thursday. Let's play a little Would You Rather.
It's time for Would You Rather on Writer Than You.
Bogues, you just said last segment you have not seen a no-hitter in person. So Would you rather witness a no-hitter or catch a foul ball?
I'd rather see a no-hitter. Foul balls are caught by multiple people every single game. Like that, I've never caught one. Have you caught one?
Not a foul ball.
I have picked one up that landed near me. Like, I got to it. We missed it. It was, like, in a chair. I grabbed it. That's the only one I've ever gotten my hands on. But I didn't catch it. There's a guy the other day who caught a home run ball one-handed. Like, you can't.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. But still, give me the no-no. They're still so rare. They're so impressive. I want to be on that short list. Not foul balls. Anyone can get one.
Well, we didn't have history in that game. We did have MLB history made yesterday as Cubs reliever Andrew Kittredge threw the 120th ever immaculate inning pitch. Those that I know, it's 3 strikeouts on 9 pitches. Boom, 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 boom. And then one more time. Boom, boom, boom. So would you rather witness an immaculate inning or watch a player hit for the cycle?
I'm going to go cycle here. Is it me or is this immaculate inning thing like a brand new phenomenon? It's like I've heard a lot of things in baseball. The golden sombrero, hitting for the cycle, 4 homer game. This immaculate inning thing, it's impressive, but that feels just a little too gimmicky. I don't care at all to see one of those. But hit for the cycle, you know it's coming, it's developing. A triple is kind of always fun because that's a long trip on the bases. Like, the cycle for me, that's an easy one.
Does it change your answer at all that there's been almost 3 times as many cycles as immaculate innings?
Yeah, immaculate innings do nothing for me. Like, it just seems like a thing you say, like, in passing. But a cycle, whether or not it's more rare or not, it seems cooler and seems more of an actual accomplishment.
So yesterday on the show, we talked a lot about smelling salts. We initially thought they were banned. Now it's just teams can't provide them, but players can bring their own. But in terms of getting ready for a game, Bogues, if you were an athlete, would you rather get slapped in the face like John Henderson or throw up before every game like Josh Allen?
Yeah, I'd rather get slapped in the face. I guess that depends on who's doing the slapping and the velocity of the slap. But the puking before every game, I was around a college basketball coach that apparently did that. Thankfully, was not there for the throwing up, but the story was that he puked before every game. That doesn't seem healthy to me. That can't be good. To be that nervous, puking's awful. Like, thank God I haven't been sick like that, knock on whatever this desk is made out of, in a long time. I don't remember the last time I threw up. No thanks. And under any situation.
Got a Jerry Seinfeld streak going there in the throat? How about this? All right, so Mike Vrabel yesterday, Patriots head coach, tried to break up a scrum going on in practice, ended up getting in the middle of it, and walked out with a bloody cheek. Would you rather, if you had to pick one here, fight Mike Vrabel or fight Dan Campbell?
Where's the running away option? How did I stupidly get into this fight? I guess I'd rather fight Vrabel, because I think from a distance, Vrabel would get to a sympathetic feeling towards my pummeled body sooner than Dan Campbell. Dan Campbell's crazier. Dan Campbell wouldn't stop. Dan Campbell would bite kneecaps. Ha ha ha. He would do all the things. I think Vrabel at some point would go, okay, he's dead, I'm going to leave him alone. Campbell would have to be pulled off of my lifeless body. So I'd rather fight Vrabel.
Campbell's crazy. If I think he'd bring you back to life just to kill
fight
you
me again.
And let's finish here. A story just came recently here in New York City that a severed foot washed up on the shores of Staten Island. So if you were at the beach, Bogues, would you rather see a severed foot wash up or see a shark on the water?
Oh, I want to see a shark for sure. Fascinated. I love the ocean. I'm scared of a lot of things. I am not a thrill seeker. I don't need roller coasters, none of that stuff. But I love sharks so much that if you offered it, I would go from right now to this show to a boat, take me out in the water, drop me in one of those metal cages, and let great whites swim around me. Like, that's how badly I want to see a shark in person. So please. But the other part of your question is not that bad either. Like, I'm a big Law and Order fan and like crime shows. Like, I want to be the person who's jogging through the park and finds a dead body. I don't want to know them. I'm not rooting for death, but what's that? Oh my God. Like, I want to be an eyewitness to something. Now, again, the beginning of the story that leads to the severed foot, not ideal. Not asking for that, not rooting for that. But, you know, if Mariska Hargitay needs somebody to find her next victim in a park, or Christopher Maloney, I'll take a jog. I'll see what I can come up with.
All right, Detective Bogues, good to know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not going to stick around. I'm not going to, you know...
Oh, you just want to be there for the discovery?
I'm not going to swab for fingerprints or
anything.
What's
the fun in just discovering?
I don't know, I just... Seems, I don't know if I want to, do I want to be an actor?
Hey, look, a dead body over there.
Yeah.
I'll see you guys later. My
I want the detective to go, that guy found it. And they come over and they talk to me like, yeah, I was just running through here and I saw this weird bump in the leaves. So I went to check and there was a foot. I want to be that guy. And then I'm going to go home. And then I got a story. That's all I need. I just want the story, I guess. Evan Washburn is a far more sane individual as far as I know. He'll join us when we come back on Writer Than You.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast.
And Bill Ryder is on vacation. Andrew Bogish in for him on this Thursday. It's hour two of the show. Thanks, as always, for being with us on the Infinity Sports Network, on the Odyssey app, on SiriusXM, channel 375. It is time to class the joint up just a little bit here, talking NFL football with the one and only Evan Washburn from NFL on CBS. Evan, it is Andrew. It's great to meet you. Thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be here, Andrew. Thanks.
Evan, I think... a lot of people, a lot of fans realize broadcasting crews like you guys show up Friday or Saturday for a Sunday game. But I don't know that everybody knows what you guys go through this time of year to get ready for the regular season. So run us through what your summer schedule is like.
Yeah, I would say everybody has their own process because the real work for us doesn't start until week one. But I found, especially in the reporter role, that if you can make your way to training camps, I try to get to between 8 and 10 each July and August. It's really a nice way to set the foundation for the year, and it gives you a nice recall, too, when you're with the team in week four, and you can, whether it's in a meeting or on the sideline, reference something that you saw or heard or a conversation you had back in late July, early August. It's helpful. And then on top of that, I do the Ravens preseason games, so that's a nice way to get to know those folks and teams they're playing for the first three preseason games and kind of get the muscles going again.
Now, I know that just yesterday CBS put out their week one assignments. Do you know further than that? Are you picking teams that you know you're going to see during the season?
I do know weeks two and three, but when I'm picking my training camp tour, I'm basically hedging a lot based
gotcha.
Off of previous scenarios, what teams are good. Our crew, Ian, and now J.J. Watt and myself usually have the main 1 o'clock game, so it's a lot of AFC North, AFC East, and then you sprinkle in some NFC teams along the way. So if I'm going to see 10 teams, I'll pick 7 that I know we're going to see a bunch, and then 3 that I just think are interesting.
I was going to ask you about JJ joining you and Ian. I know Ian well. He is not a big, imposing guy. I don't know if you are that. You're not a defensive lineman. So how do we handle the hazing and the break-in of JJ Watt here?
Well, that's the beauty of broadcasting. Your physical stature really holds no water. So we're all equals on the mic. But no, it'll be fun. It's exciting to have JJ with us. He's already brought a ton of energy, and his perspective will be so unique based off of the fact that he's not far removed from the field, and he pretty much knows everything about the game and probably knows everyone in the game right now. So I'm excited to see how that impacts us. And as for the hazing, I would say it'll be probably left for maybe some of those Friday evening meals and
gotcha.
Drinks.
You were most recently with the Steelers. What are the two or three main takeaways you got from their camp?
Well, first of all, I just think Mike Tomlin, who's a guy who's always juiced and has a ton of belief in his team, was next level in terms of his excitement for what they've built and bringing in the names they have and the way they've built this roster, whether you want to call it all in, win now. He's thrilled to have a group of proven vets, and it starts with Aaron Rodgers. And that's probably the biggest question mark, too, is where is he physically and what does that mean in terms of what he can provide them from that position. But having just been around that team and that organization so much over the last 10 plus years, it did feel a little different in terms of the excitement and energy for what was a Wednesday practice in early August.
And what about just the way they've attacked this offseason with Rodgers and DK Metcalf? It's not like the Steelers that you've been covering for so many years now.
It's not, but I would say they don't really rebuild. So in some ways it's on brand because they have a standard, and that's Mike Tomlinism that is most common, that the standard is the standard, and the standard for them, as he put it even with us yesterday, is chasing Lombardi. And some teams don't attack off seasons that same way. They have more of a, whether you want to call it a long view, or they recognize where they are and they have to reset, and they maybe take their lumps for a season or two and build back up. I just don't think that's the approach in Pittsburgh, especially when you look at where they are roster makeup on the defensive side with guys like Cam Hayward and even TJ Watt in year 9, that they want to try and attack this window.
Evan, I thought Aaron Rodgers made the Jets an elite team and then the Achilles popped. I thought they were still going to be good last year and they were not as good as I thought they were going to be. What does your gut tell you about Rodgers' ability here to still play this position at a high level for a good team in Pittsburgh?
I think high level is just kind of where you have to find your frame of reference. I look at it more like Brett Favre in Minnesota in one of those final 2 years where he captured enough to help a team that had a ton of talent make a run at an NFC title game. And I think that's the thing in Pittsburgh with Aaron. He doesn't have to be 2018, 2017, or even 2019 Aaron Rodgers. He just has to kind of orchestrate, manage that offense, and then make a couple big throws late in games. And I still think that's plenty in his arsenal. We saw it down the stretch last year. And the strength of that team, Steelers, that is, will be their defense. So it's not a situation. And I don't think Aaron's coming into this thinking, I've got to be chucking it all over the yard and putting up MVP numbers. I just need to make enough plays in the critical moments of games that last year, whether it was Justin Fields or obviously Russell Wilson for the majority of the year, just couldn't make.
Evan Washburn, NFL on CBS, is with us here this morning on Writer Than You on the Infinity Sports Network. Evan, you've also seen the Bengals this summer, and Zach Taylor said 2 days ago, unlike previous years, a lot of their frontline guys, including Joe Burrow, are going to play in the preseason. Do you think that actually will help them this year? And then the bigger picture, where do you fall, generally speaking, on whether or not star players should suit up here in the preseason?
I think it will help. I think that playing in the preseason is valuable, but it obviously comes with a risk. So it's like anything in life, the cost-benefit analysis has to be weighed. And I think for Cincinnati and Zach Taylor, a guy who has done some impressive things in 6 years, is looking at a season where he needs to deliver out of the gate in terms of his leadership and his team's production, because they've won one week, one game in his entire time as a head coach there. And the last two seasons, they've missed the playoffs largely due to slow starts of the season, whether it was 0-2 or 1-3. And I think that's where, when you do the cost-benefit analysis, the benefit of them playing will benefit them as no critical piece gets hurt. So it's a risk, and I think it's a smart one. And for, I'm doing a Ravens game tonight, is it smart for Lamar Jackson to play tonight? No. Do they need him to play tonight? No. And will they be successful week one? They might lose, but I don't think it's going to be because Lamar didn't or didn't play in a preseason game. So that's kind of how I view it.
I was going to ask you about Lamar later on, but let's get to him now since you just brought him up. We began the show talking about Josh Allen and figuring out which quarterbacks have the most pressure on them coming into this new season. Is Lamar number one on that list in your mind?
I think he and Josh are probably one and 1A, and the term pressure is fair. I just think that they have one thing left to do. And I mean, you could argue it's two things. It's getting to a Super Bowl and then winning. But at least getting there is a big step for that resume. And I think they both carry that weight. I think what maybe makes Lamar's a little bit heavier is that he has not played his best in some of the critical moments. Everybody remembers last year's Mark Andrews drop in Buffalo. Well, Lamar had a couple ugly turnovers early in that game that even he's referenced as recent as training camp, when speaking to the fact that he's taken care of the ball so well in the regular season and then hasn't been able to in the postseason. So if you're matching me up with those two, I'd probably take Baltimore.
Yeah, and it also feels to me, at least, that there's more people eager to criticize Lamar than Josh. Like, there's still a lot of leash for Josh, but it feels like Lamar has, to a certain extent, almost run out of support right now. Like, there's people who just want to be mean to him and want to tear him down.
Man, I don't know. That's one of those things where it's like, what corner of the internet are you living in?
I guess so, right?
Maybe it's because I'm too close to it. I think there's a lot of love for both of them, and obviously, Josh has got the power of Hard Knocks behind him right now, and he delivers in all those settings, but so does Lamar. So, yeah, I mean, it's the nature of the beast, and they both know that. And Lamar's, I would say, as a group, that Ravens squad is plenty happy with people doubting him.
Speaking of quarterbacks, you've seen the Vikings, which means you've seen J.J. McCarthy. Do you think he can be good enough to keep them at the top of the NFC?
I have no idea, to be honest with you, Andrew. It's one day of practice,
yeah.
So I'm really careful about having too strong an opinion. I think, talking to Kevin O'Connell for an extended period of time, he believes it, so I'm a believer in him as a head coach and an offensive play caller and a guy who develops that position really well. So if he's all in and he believes it, then I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But it's going to be a lot. I mean, talk about pressure. I would say J.J. McCarthy has probably the most pressure of anybody in the NFL at that position, just because it's rare that we have a quarterback who's, for all intents and purposes, a rookie under center for a team that has all the talent and pieces necessary, both on the sideline and on the roster to win a Super Bowl. So he's got to handle that. They're doing a nice job protecting him, I think, from having to talk about it too much and just kind of letting him put the work in now and hopefully ease his way into what's a pretty important job here this season for him.
Yeah, probably would have been the question would have been better from me if it was more along the lines of what sense did you get from them about how much they'll actually rely on him as opposed to kind of protecting him and keeping things simple for him here early in the season.
I think it'll start with, I mean, simple, you can only do so much in terms of simplifying at that position, but I think they're not going to ask him to do everything out of the gate. They're going to lean on their defense, which is top five, and have JJ make some throws when he needs to and run the offense, not turn the ball over, all those important things. And then as he gets more comfortable, then put more on his plate. I think that's what makes Kevin O'Connell so good. I mean, he's been out there about how he feels like sometimes young quarterbacks get quote unquote ruined by having to do too much or having too much asked of him. And I can't imagine he'd get anywhere close to making that mistake with JJ.
Evan, last thing, and I'll let you run. And again, thanks for making time for us this morning. We really appreciate it. A month from opening night, is there any team that you think we're sleeping on right now that maybe there's a little more attention in the run-up to week one?
I don't know if they're sleeping on them, but I think the Houston Texans, if I was to argue a group, or excuse me, a team that's outside of the top three, which I would have as Kansas City, Buffalo, and Baltimore, that I think could knock on that door and really has been knocking on the door and probably burst through, to keep burying that metaphor, would be the Houston Texans. Their defense is going to be awesome. Their secondary is legit. I mean, Stingley's got paid for that reason. Lassiter's in year two looks like a Pro Bowler, and then they bring in C.J. Gardner-Johnson. They got Hunter, Will Anderson up front. I mean, they're gonna wreck the AFC South. And then if C.J. Stroud can get command of this Nick Caley offense, that's a lot like the McDaniels offense in New England, then I think he's going to look every bit like he did, obviously, his rookie year where he burst on the scene. And for points of last year, I thought he took a lot of criticism that was unwarranted for what ended up being a similar result, or exactly the same record, the same result, and just more sacks and a few more interceptions. So I'm a believer in Houston.
Evan, thanks again for this. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your summer, and hopefully we can get you again during the season.
Yeah, man. Anytime. Thanks.
All right. That's Evan Washburn, one of the best in the business, NFL on CBS reporter. He, Ian Eagle, and J.J. Watt, they've got Jets Steelers in week one, accidentally putting the Jets and Steelers together. Remember, the schedule came out before, obviously, Aaron Rodgers was going to Pittsburgh. And at the very least, that was going to be Justin Fields against the Steelers. But there was even the inkling back then of Aaron Rodgers. And that's a week one doozy. And Ian and JJ and Evan will be there to do that on CBS. Again, huge thanks to Evan. We appreciate him jumping on with us. It is time to do buy or sell. Hickey takes over when we come back. Writer Than You on the Infinity Sports Network.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast.
Welcome back to Writer Than You.
Remember when we did a game show and you couldn't come up with Cam Newton? Dane, we should play that rejoin.
You like that one, huh? You really
I
like
really
that
do.
One.
Yeah.
Is that the lasting moment? Like, if I was to pass away tomorrow.
Yes. I got to write the obit. Ryan Hickey, a beloved fiance and son and great friend who was known for his humor, humility, and radio excellence, and also once couldn't get Cam Newton's name backwards over a 5-minute period, unfortunately died Thursday after a freak pickleball accident. He was 31.
On the Infinity Sports Network.
It's a pretty good bio, obit there for you, Hickey. And I've got to be honest, I was worried for your well-being in hearing that clip for the first time. I didn't know it happened when it happened live. And then when the first time Bill played it for me, I was impressed that you had survived up until that point. Like, we've all had brain farts, but that one hurt to hear. But I feel like you've recovered.
Well, I've recovered in part because we've, since that, back in 2019, have yet to have another competition where
that
I
have
to
is 6 years old.
decode names of athletes backwards. It's the thing was the win. Like, the W for whatever reason is stuck in my mind. Win. I'm like, W, W, W. What's W? And that's when it goes to Jameis Winston. That's how we go from Cam Newton backwards, Mac not win, to Jameis Winston. It was... Also, not to mention, I'm not good under pressure at all. I would be a terrible Jeopardy contestant.
No, I hear you. I hear you. But it just, there's nothing about, even your explanation, there's nothing about not win that gets you to Jameis Winston.
Oh, I just told you that for whatever reason, inexplicable. No one else would do it. I crack under pressure. That's the biggest thing.
This portion of the show is sponsored by the Hyundai Getaway Sales Event. Going on now. Get deals so right, it almost feels wrong. Don't miss out. Visit your local Hyundai dealer today.
What side will Bill take on the biggest issues in the world of sports? It's time for today's edition of Buy or Sell on Writer Than You.
Let's talk quarterbacks, Bogues.
We're Let's not
gonna
do it.
Talk backwards names of quarterbacks. But in college football, Ohio State head coach Ryan Day gave an update on the quarterback competition yesterday going on between Julian Sayin and Lincoln Kienholz. Take a listen.
I've been pleased with the progress. We're not where we need to be. But if they continue to learn from the mistakes they're making and continue to grow off the plays that they're doing well and moving the offense and taking care of the football, then it's going to go right down to the wire.
So buy or sell, you are concerned that neither quarterback so far has separated themselves with that Texas game looming just 23 days away.
Buy or sell, you know Stlonik is the backwards form of which quarterback's name in this question? No?
Wait.
Stlonik.
Is it Lincoln?
Yeah, it is Lincoln, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not staying. You did it, Icky.
I did it. Well,
you
when
did
you
it.
Me two options of basically Julian Sander and Lincoln Keyholz, and I'm like, the L gave it away.
Okay, as long as you got to the finish line, I'm proud of you. So, buy or sell my concern that neither QB has separated themselves. Yeah, I'm gonna buy this.
Buy.
And were they number two in the coaches poll preseason Ohio State?
Yes, they were.
I don't know how you can vote them number two. And I understand the wide receiver room. I understand the history. They are always good. They're always productive. They are always top to bottom. One of the most talented, deep rosters in the country. I get all of that. But at the most important position, they're picking between guys not just having a competition, but all the competitors are basically newbies. Like, I don't think they've taken 100 combined snaps, Sangin and Keenholz. So whomever wins this job is going to be learning how to be a Division I quarterback at Ohio State on the fly, beginning with Texas. I don't know how you can be so confident in all of that, even with Ryan Day's expertise and the staff's expertise and the stud wide receivers, which that's a huge benefit to whoever wins the job. But this position is too important, and these two guys are still too inexperienced to have any real confidence in the Buckeyes in terms of like top five, top 10. We're really just extra guessing with them. But to your specific question, yeah, it'd be great. I mean, it's August 8th, 7th. We are 3 weeks away from games. You would have liked somebody to be the guy by now, and apparently that's not the case at all.
Like you said, new running back room, three new offensive linemen, new coordinator. Defense is all brand new. It's a lot of question marks.
It's a lot. And then the question mark of question marks. The one question mark that could ruin the entire dynamic.
With no warm-up. It's boom, Texas week one, let's go.
Right.
Entire country watching, good luck.
And we're not talking about two fifth-year senior grad transfers who played somewhere else or stepping up in competition. Like, these are guys that have barely played. Sagan only played mop-up duty fourth quarter snaps, and I think he threw five passes. So if that guy is going to be the star, I'm not saying he can't do it, but it's not like he's walking in a seasoned vet. It's not a good recipe for success, especially early in the season.
No, it's not. But this could be a good recipe for success for college football fans overall. Yesterday on ESPN, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell gave an update for fans on what they can expect from the Red Zone channel after ESPN this week purchased the network. Take a listen.
It'll continue to be produced right here in this building. It will be the NFL Red Zone. I don't think fans will see any difference to that. Obviously, in the context of that, though, ESPN purchased the Red Zone name, and they will be able to utilize that for other sports, college football and other things.
So NFL Red Zone, not changing, yeah, but this, buy or sell, Bogues, you would watch a college football Red Zone show.
I mean, would anybody not buy this?
Buy!
This might be the most unanimous buy in the history of this segment. Why? NFL Red Zone is almost perfect. So a college football one should start out perfect. It might get ruined by the wrong host or whatever. At sometimes there's just so much going on. It might be overwhelming. But if I could sit there and be ushered from game to game, sign me up right now. In fact, I'm already signed up, so I don't need to do anything else.
Let me ask you this then. Would you be more excited for a college football Red Zone or NFL Red Zone if you had to choose one?
My first thought is the NFL will be better because even as crazy as some of those, the witching hour, the 3 to 4:30 window can get on a Sunday, college football just seems overwhelming at times. Or there's nothing. Or we complain that there's no good games, right? Sometimes there's six going on at one time and you don't know where to look. Other times you're scrambling for a game to pay attention to. I think the NFL Red Zone success rate will always be higher than a college football one.
In baseball yesterday, the Red Sox locked up their phenom Roman Anthony, signing him to an 8-year, $130 million extension. Remember, Anthony is a rookie called up just on June 9th, so not even 2 months into his MLB career. He's getting a brand new deal. That was worth it so far, hitting .283 in the season. His .400 on-base percentage is fourth in all of baseball. Buy or sell, the Red Sox will win this deal more than Anthony.
Oh, buy.
Buy.
And I think it's always a buy on the team side in this. This trend of these young players giving up a couple years of free agency, signing long-term now. There's also escalators and stuff. This deal can be like $230 million, I think, over an additional year or two. So there's money, there's extra money to be made by Roman Anthony. But I think this takes him through being like 29, 30. Juan Soto didn't do this, and Juan Soto got paid at 26, and now, so like, it's hard to say don't sign for nine figures right now, bet on yourself and cash in, get the real huge contract sooner rather than later. It would be hard to say no to 8 years and 130 mil. But I think players should say no to these deals and get to free agency at a normal time and get a huge deal. This is always, locking in cost is always pro team. And there's very, it's crazy to say this at 130 mil. There's also very little downside for the Red Sox here. They can only win this by Anthony being as good as we think he's going to be and then being cheap. If he doesn't turn out that well, they'll be okay paying him this money or having to get rid of him. So this is a definitely buy for the Red Sox.
As you look ahead to the NFL season starting here, surely Travis Kelce told reporters yesterday that he moved on from the Super Bowl loss very quickly. And this anecdote from Peter Schrager of ESPN, he revealed recently as well, that Patrick Mahomes was back in the gym training less than 2 days after the Super Bowl loss. Buy or sell, the Chiefs are more likely to make the Super Bowl than the Eagles this season.
I'm going to sell that.
Sell.
I'm going to sell it for the law of averages and for football. The Chiefs are only a year older. They're doing their best to fill in youth-wise at other places, but Mahomes is only older. Travis Kelce, obviously, is only older. And I think there's a few extra dangerous teams in the AFC than in the NFC at the moment. So, and at some point, they just have to lose one of these January games, don't they? So, I don't know that either one of them gets back, but if I had to pick somebody today, it would be the Eagles and not the Chiefs.
Just to close the bow on what you said earlier about the Bills and their four Super Bowl appearances in a row.
Right.
If the Chiefs do make it back, four in a row for them.
I know, that's crazy.
It's crazy, right? The Steelers are maybe looking to be one of those teams that gets in the way of the Chiefs in terms of them going to four straight Super Bowls. They kick off the preseason on Saturday against the Jaguars, which could mean this is the first time we see Aaron Rodgers in the black and yellow officially. Now, when asked if Rodgers would play in the preseason opener, the four-time MVP said he's fully on board if Mike Tomlin did ask him. So buy or sell, Aaron Rodgers should play in the preseason.
Oh, I'll reluctantly buy this.
Buy.
New team, new situation. He didn't get there as early as he could have. I think a couple of series make sense. I've got no problem with Lamar Jackson never seeing a preseason snap. Josh Allen probably shouldn't. I still think in Cincinnati, I would err on the side of caution and not put Joe Burrow out there. But I think it would behoove the Steelers to get one dry run of Rodgers out there, just moving around, throwing a Metcalf, whatever it may be. And I to be honest, I don't know the situation like where their offensive line is health-wise and stuff like that right now. Obviously, there's maybe a situation where it makes zero sense for him to be out there. But all things being equal, I'd give him a couple of series just to get, just so that week one, we're not doing it for real for the first time.
And let's finish with this. Teddy Bridgewater is back in the NFL as the Buccaneers backup. Met with the media. He's back in the NFL in part because he was suspended as Miami Northwestern's head coach for providing impermissible benefits. Now, Bridgewater did open up yesterday about the benefits he did provide.
You know, I'm a father first before anything. And when I decided to coach, you know, those players became my sons. And I wanted to make sure that I just protect them in the best way that I can. And, you know, I think that's what came about. You know, Miami Northwestern is in a tough neighborhood, and, you know, sometimes things can happen when kids are walking home and different things like that. So I just tried to protect them, you know, give them, you know, a ride home instead of them having to take those dangerous walks.
Buy or sell, Bogues? Teddy Bridgewater should not have been suspended for looking out for his kids.
Oh, I hate this question from you so much. I guess I'm going to sell this.
Sell.
I would really like for more level-headed thinking to have come in here. I would like situations, rules maybe to be changed, but I guess technically he broke a rule, so they've got to do something about this. If you don't know this story, Teddy Bridgewater went back to his high school, his alma mater, became the head coach, and then got suspended, not fired and not suspended, but suspended for paying for Uber rides to get kids back and forth to practice. That's what he was just talking about there. He paid for team meals, and I believe he also paid for some like recovery services. Like, I don't know if there were massages, if they were cold tubs, but they all fall under the line of this is supposed to be an equal playing field. This school can't do extra stuff to make it more appealing to students or whatever. And as far as I know, if like just a parent had done this, or like a, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But the fact that he was the head coach, I think, is the specific problem. I would love for to live in a world where he didn't have to do this. But if he did do it, it would also be okay, because I believe him that it's coming from just a very genuine, honest place. But you also need to know that there are rules in place, and you should maybe check with people before doing good things that may, because sometimes sports rules are dumb, get you or the program in trouble. And by the way, it leads to him going, I'm done coaching high school football. Get me an NFL job. And he's a Buccaneer now. It's not a great story. There's no easy answer. And there's a lot of kind of logic defying thoughts in all of this, because he is trying to help kids in a tough spot. But you also have, whatever the rules may be, you might think they're stupid, they might be short-sighted, but if they're there, you have to follow them. It's very parenting of me, I feel like. And that was Teddy's argument too. All right, buy or sell's done. I feel like I meant to write down a buy or sell question for you specifically. It crossed my mind last night. I'm like, oh, tacking on at the end, that might, Hickey might laugh at that, and now I don't remember it. Good job by me by writing it down.
Well, if you think of it, we can bring the music back, we'll get the sounders back,
we'll do it again.
And we'll run it back.
We'll take it from the top. Maybe we'll do that, but we'll definitely talk about Archie and Arch Manning to close out the show. But first things first, here's your update. Here's Peter Schwartz.
Infinity Sports Network Sports Flash.
And we'll start with a few NFL preseason games on tap for tonight. First up, 7 Eastern for the Colts at the Ravens. Then it's the Bengals visiting the Eagles. Bengals head coach Zach Taylor has this view of a first preseason game.
A little longer of a in-season Friday mindset for us, where we do start to gear back a little bit in terms of the physicality. So in terms of a competitive period today, there's really only 2, normally have 4. And then there's some stuff as we just start to introduce our guys to what to expect from Philly.
Kickoff tonight, 7:30 Eastern time. Also, the Raiders visit the Seahawks, and Raiders head coach Pete Carroll back in town, returning to Seattle.
It's the only game we got. Happens to be in Seattle. You know, I loved my time in Seattle, and loved the fans and the people that we met and dealt with and competed with. But it's a game for us. We can go play ball.
Kickoff for the Raiders and Seahawks in Seattle tonight, 10 o'clock Eastern time. Afternoon baseball coming up, 12:05 Eastern for the A's at the Nationals. I'm Peter Schwartz.
You're listening to the Writer Than You podcast.
All right, I'll talk now. It's Andrew Bogus in for Bill Ryder. Final few minutes on this Thursday. Thanks once again to Bill and to Hickey for letting me hang out with them, with Bill on vacation. He's back on Monday. Jody McDonald has you tomorrow. I'll be on in the morning with Maggie Gray, Maggie and Perloff. Perloff is, he's on vacation. I don't think with Bill in Iowa. I think they are separately with their families, but I'm moving around. Musical chairs continue here on the network. So A, thanks for always listening. B, thanks for your patience. And C, we'll all be back in our normal positions sometime when we get to September and football is finally here. I just saw a couple of this matters to different groups of people, but we are now up against our first full weekend of NFL preseason action, so teams are making decisions that we've been talking about the last 2 days. Who plays, who doesn't in these preseason games? The Bills just said that Josh Allen is not going to play Saturday against the Giants. The Giants have not revealed their full plans for who will be out there in that game. But Brian Daboll did say this morning that Jackson Dart, their first-round QB, he will play Saturday. Didn't say if he'll start, didn't say he'll be second, didn't say he'd get the most reps, but did confirm that Jackson Dart will be out there. Of course, there are three games tonight, another handful of games on Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday as well. So we've got four straight days of NFL preseason action. And as always is the case with the NFL, almost every single game has a significant theme to it, whether it's a quarterback battle, whether it's a rookie QB, whether it's J.J. McCarthy, whether it's Aaron Rodgers and the Steelers, it might be Pete Carroll against the Seahawks again. There's always something about these games that will draw us in and give us so much to actually finally start talking about, not just projecting, not just reading into practice stats and quick clips that the media can get at training camp. We're going to get guys against other guys on the field in as, you know, close to a real situation as we can possibly get. Now, at some point, an NFL conversation will be had about Arch Manning playing for somebody at quarterback. But for the moment, he remains at Texas, and he is now the Longhorns' starting quarterback because Quinn Ewers is gone. And just this morning, a snippet began making the rounds of Archie Manning, who began all of this, the grandfather, Peyton and Eli's dad, and Arch's grandfather and his namesake, did an interview, a long-form interview, with a Texas magazine. And in that, he said fairly, like, finally and declaratively that Arch is going to play next year as well at Texas, that the plan is for him not to be in the 2026 NFL draft. And I think for the most part, we assume he's going to be the number one pick whichever draft he is in. His last name is always going to win a battle over a Nussmeier, a Sellers, a Mateer, anybody else you want to put out there. Arch is always going to win the head-to-head, assuming he's not a completely useless college player, which is not going to happen, right? But as Arch says this, and obviously we have almost an entire year for things to change, but as Arch says that the plan is for his grandson to play 2 years at Texas, it has me asking again, how actually good is this kid? Because there is no need, you know, once you've got to spend your time in college, you can't leave after high school. Once you get to college, you've got to play your 3 years or your 3 years in between high school graduation and being in the NFL draft. So you've got to go to college for a little bit. Obviously, NIL does not matter to Arch whatsoever. There is no rush to go make NFL money. This is just about football, which makes it a little, you know, you get a little more patience, whatever. I just don't understand. If he is as good as we almost universally believe he is, that the Manning family was okay with him sitting behind Quinn Ewers for two seasons, and now going, he's going to play 2 years and then go to the NFL. So he's going to spend the full 4 years in college, and that he needs a second year of seasoning, that he needs a second year of prep work. This is as confusing and inconsistent as I can remember. And you got to throw in all the things said about him by outsiders. Paul Feinbaum saying that Arch is the best college quarterback since Tim Tebow. And I'll acknowledge the blowout that Paul Feinbaum has over me in terms of broadcasting skills, college football knowledge, skill evaluation. But when he says that sentence, I have to call BS. Because if Arch was that good, he would have played over Quinn Ewers. And I don't care what the agreements were, the plan was regarding Quinn Ewers or Arch Manning. But if he was as impactful as Tim Tebow was at Florida, Quinn Ewers wasn't that. So Steve Sarkisian was okay keeping the better quarterback on the bench for 2 years. And I know they won a lot of games and got very close to a national title, but maybe they win one if Arch is that good. But instead, they're cool, the Mannings, with him sitting there and not playing for 2 years. 1 year, no debate. Year two, and plus in year two, you got the window, you had the door open because Ewers got hurt. So now you're not even making just a straight football evaluation. Now you've got, oh, he's hurt, he can't play, not our decision. And then Arch goes in and doesn't light the world on fire. And once Quinn is ready to go, he goes right back in there. So they got the opening that they needed to avoid as many hard feelings as possible. The injury was, I assumed, when Arch didn't get the job to begin with last season, that either they were just giving Quinn one last chance to prove something or kind of secretly hoping that it would the decision would be taken out of their hands by something like an injury. And then the injury happened, and Arch plays, and I thought that was the beginning of the end for Quinn Ewers, and Arch is, and here we go now into the Arch Manning era. And he was fine, but he wasn't great. And then they didn't hesitate to put Quinn Ewers back out there. And in fact, I think they put him back out there when we weren't sure how exactly healthy he was, which meant that they were kind of in a rush to get him back out there. And then you fast forward to now, and he's the starter, and he's going to play, and we're going to get some answers. And now the Manning family is okay with him spending another, a second year in college playing and not going to the NFL. They're okay with him not being the number one pick in the 2026 draft and just waiting. I just, something's off here. Something doesn't line up, or I'm just a dummy. But there have been other guys who are asking these same questions, as if he's this good, why didn't he play already? And why won't he be in the next NFL draft? And he still may turn out to be great. And usually I prefer patience over rushing a guy on the field. Like, I still don't think if you take, you know, I don't, they obviously are going to, and they had no other choice, but if the Titans had a better short-term choice, I would not be sitting here telling you that Cam Ward had to be their default starting quarterback just because he's the number one pick. I have seen too many guys ruined that position by playing too fast. I'm okay with you slow playing that. Perfectly fine with it. I would never demand someone play, but that's not what we're doing here with Arch. This is not August of his freshman year. This is August of year three, and he's only just now, because Ewers is finally gone, getting a chance to play, and Grandpa's already saying, well, he's going nowhere after this year. We're going to run this back in 2026. That's not how you handle elite quarterbacks. Whatever their last name is, whatever their financial situation is, whatever you think they're going to be in the NFL, I don't know what I'm missing here. And I think it's a very fair question to ask, actually, how good is he if he didn't beat Ewers? Because again, if he's the next Manning legend, he should have been clearly better than Quinn Ewers. And whatever promises, plans were in place, coaches want to win football games. And maybe it would have taken a little bit longer, but at some point they would have went, Quinny buddy, sorry, man. I know we did this. I know you did that. I love everything you did for us. You're a Longhorn forever. But I don't think we can win the last game of the year with you, but I think we can with Arch. So Arch is going to play. And then they got the open door from the injury, and then they put him back out there. Something is just not right here. Jamie is in Dallas, and he's up next here on Writer Than You. Jamie, thanks for calling, man. What's up?
Man, I think you're dead on. I've been saying this. This is the second coming of Chris Sims and Major Applewhite, okay? This kid has been hyped to the nines. He's about to walk out there with the one running back and one wide receiver, and the right guard are the only things that are close to returning starters. Okay, really, the right guard is the only one that really, really was an every game starter last year. That's coming back on the whole rest of the team. Both tackles go to the NFL. Center, left guard, they're gone. Tight end's gone. First round draft pick at wide receiver gone. Cedric Baxter's probably going to come back, but he blew his knee out back at running back. You got this guy, the amount of hype and the way Texas believes and thinks about itself, and they're so delusional. And that's what everybody's caught in right now. But they're not. They got a lot of talent on defense, yes. But on the offensive side, outside of Wingo, like, who knows what that is? They're talking about a starting left tackle, starting right tackle. It's a true freshman. Hey, one of the wide receivers.
Jimmy, I got to jump in here for Jimmy. Yep. I got to jump in because I did a bad job for you and didn't check out the clock, and we're just about to show. But in Texas' defense, they didn't create Arch Manning. I mean, Arch was Arch before he got there. But maybe Archie is seeing all the things that you just pointed out and thinks that they're not going to have a great year because of new offensive linemen, loss of skill position players. And he thinks that's going to make Arch not have a great year. And they're thinking that 2026 is the time where he can really show off who he is. But I still can't believe that they are in almost a negative rush to get him into the NFL. Thank you again to Bill for letting me hang out in his seat. He's back on Monday. Jody Mack tomorrow. Thanks today to Evan Washburn, to Peter Schwartz, to Hickey, and to you guys for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday, and we'll see you back here soon. Writer Than You on the Infinity Sports Network.